If it please the court, Todd McIntosh, registration number 18899, here on behalf of Security National Mortgage Company. Pleased to be here today and appreciate this opportunity. The history of the underlying case in this matter concerns alleged mortgage fraud on the purchase of a house here in Denver. The appellant, Security National Mortgage Company, acting as the lender for the residential home, alleges that several of the named defendants acted in a conspiracy to overstate the value of a home to be purchased by elevating the appraisal and then receiving the overstated monies at closing. Security National Mortgage Company further alleges the defendant title company released those excess funds at the closing on the home in violation of the loan documents concerning the purchase of the home. The case was initially filed in April 2008. It was dismissed without prejudice on September 8, 2008 for failure to prosecute. From September 8, 2008.
Stop you, counsel. You say it was dismissed without prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why wasn't it just refiled?
Well, my understanding is that between September and January, when it was discovered by Security National that the case had been dismissed, that the statute of limitations had run. From September 8, 2008, the date when when the case was dismissed.
When did it run?
Excuse me?
Had it expired as of the date, as of September 2008? Had it expired? Is that
what you're saying? No, it expired sometime between September 8, 2008.
Yes.
When the case was dismissed and when my clients actually discovered that the case had been dismissed.
But it could have been refiled within the statutory time, but you're saying your clients didn't know it had been dismissed.
That is correct.
Okay.
So by the time they learned of the dismissal, that ship had sailed. From September 8, 2008, when the case was dismissed, through January 22, 2009, Security National was not aware that the case was dismissed. It was only in response to a receipt by Security National concerning a bankruptcy filing that it received the second week of January 2009 that Security National learned of a possible dismissal. Upon receipt of that bankruptcy pleading, Security National immediately contacted its Denver counsel, Mr. John Head.
Ask you another question.
Sure.
Without having a calendar, you agree that January 22nd is less than 6 months from the date of dismissal, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. You bet. Yeah. Upon receipt of the bankruptcy pleading, Security National immediately contacted Denver counsel, Mr. John Head, to inquire about the status of the case. The first contact about the possible dismissal of the case was made on January the 8th. However, even when Mr. Head was asked point blank about whether the case had been dismissed, Mr. Head instead ignored the query and, after effectively dodging the questions for another 6 days, continued to offer options for prosecution of the case and potential settlement through email. It was not until Security National contacted counsel for the title company on January the 22nd, 2009, that Security National received a copy of the dismissal and learned that the case had indeed been dismissed. From September 8, 2008 through January 2009, Mr. Head, the previous counsel for Security National, never communicated to Security National that the case was dismissed. To the contrary, far from just hiding the fact that the case had been dismissed, the email correspondences from Mr. Head, which this court has, dated in December and in January, actively misled Security National to believe that indeed the case was still active. There is no question or dispute in the record that Mr. Head concealed and in fact actively misled Security National regarding the prosecution of its case. Security National believes that Mr. Head's nefarious concealment, as well as his active and ongoing misleading of Security National, evidences conduct which calls for the equitable application of Rule 60B5 instead of 60B1.
Would it be that Mr. Head's conduct constitutes fraud? They actively misled your client. Would you say it was fraud? It sounds like it. Misrepresentation?
We have not alleged fraud in either of the pleadings, Judge. But we do believe that it was grossly negligent, and we do believe that it was done in an effort to conceal the true facts of the case, yes. But there was no allegation of fraud under 60B3, which would have been another option for Security National to file for a...
60B2, actually, I think.
Beg your pardon?
60B2.
Excuse me, 60B2. Thank you. Yes.
But there could have been, it sounds like, from what you're saying.
There may have been. You know, I've been doing this a little while, and I don't actively just jump around alleging fraud. We think that what was alleged was, for the facts that we had at the time, certainly sufficient for what we argued to the court.
Problem with your argument, it seems to me, is twofold. One is you seem to be alleging a ground that sounds like either mistake or inadvertence, or you say negligence, excuse or neglect, or fraud, or misrepresentation. Any one of those grounds in 60B1 or 2, which, if those are the grounds for setting aside a judgment, they have to be filed within 6 months, right?
Your Honor, with all due respect, we are not saying it was excusable neglect. To the contrary, there's a case, Farmers v. Farmers Insurance v. District Court. It's a Colorado Supreme Court case, and we set forth some of the argument in our brief. And in Farmers, the Supreme Court held that excusable neglect involves a situation where the failure to act results from circumstances which would cause a reasonably careful person to neglect a duty. It's impossible to describe the myriad situations showing excusable neglect, but in general, most situations involve unforeseen occurrences such as personal tragedy, illness, family death, destruction of files, and other similar situations which cause a reasonably prudent person to overlook a required deadline in the performance of some responsibility. Failure to act due to carelessness and negligence is not excusable neglect. On the other hand, excusable neglect occurs when there has been a failure to take proper steps at the proper time, not by consequence of carelessness, but as a result of some unavoidable hindrance or accident. So to the contrary, we're saying that Mr. Head's conduct is anything but excusable neglect.
Do you need excusable neglect in all instances to invoke the excusable neglect provision of 60B1?
Well, you could argue mistake.
No, that's not what I meant.
All right.
Have there been instances of inexcusable neglect that have been analyzed under the balancing test of excusable neglect under 60B1?
No, I understand. I'm just trying to think back on the cases that I reviewed, Your Honor, and I don't recall seeing a case where the court found inexcusable neglect was found to be excusable neglect under 60B1. We believe that because in the ruling by Judge Madden, where he did not in his ruling give any reason why he found that the conduct of Mr. Head was excusable neglect, we believe that that is the first portion of his ruling that was arbitrary in the sense of an unfairness and a decision that was not applying Colorado law.
There was no evidentiary hearing, was there? This were just based on the allegations in your motion?
Motions and affidavits and the emails, Judge, that was provided to Judge Madden, showing the email communication from Mr. Head to our client after the case was dismissed, talking about strategy for the case, settlement of the case, all the way through January 14th of 09. He was providing to the Security National a firm belief that the case was still active when in fact it had been dismissed. When you look at the definition in Farmers and you look at what the court defines, and it's not a test, it's a definitional standard of excusable neglect. When you look at that and you apply it to Mr. Head's conduct, there's nothing that was prudent or careful about the mistakes that Mr. Head made. To the contrary, he was actively concealing and misguiding Security National, such that Security National didn't even know that the case had been dismissed.
What? 60B3?
Well, I think perhaps it could, but it can also, we believe, and based upon case law that we provided to the court, I think it squarely can fall under 60B5 as well.
So the issue is, what do you do with those cases, which Judge, one of which Judge Madden cited, and I think there are others which say, if a motion can be made under one of the other five grounds, 60B6 has no, doesn't come into play.
60B5, Judge? Well, that's for one and two, I think, but not, or excuse me, one and three, but it wouldn't be for two, because one and three are the only ones that have the six-month limitation. I do want to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal, but and I have 4 minutes and 15 seconds, but I, if I can, unless you have another question on that, Judge. Security National believes that given the definitional standards set forth by the Farmers case by the Colorado Supreme Court, Judge Madden failed to apply the definitional standards to the acts and conduct of Mr. Head. And by doing that, he reached an arbitrary and unfair decision based on the facts that were before him at the time concerning Mr. Head's conduct.
The client did know dismissal in January, 6 month period.
January 22nd, Judge.
What prevented motion under 60B1?
Well, the client learned at the end of January.
Counsel for the
No. Counsel for the...
Counsel, I thought.
Oh, well, excuse me. The client learned the end of January. It's an out-of-state company. It then had to take several weeks to figure out what to do with the fact that here they have an attorney that has misrepresented it, himself in the case for 4.5 months, and then at the end of February was able to procure our representation with about 7 or 8 days left to file a motion.
Still time to file a 60B.
Well, arguably, yes, except that, you know, there are Rule 11 requirements. We had to get the file. We had to make discovery. We had to determine what was going on. We had to talk to Mr. Head. It was a very short period of time. And, Judge, I'd also argue that the rule allows for a six-month period of time for a 60B1 or 3. My client didn't get that. My client didn't know what was going on until 6 weeks left of that six-month period. So at the very least, if you're going to apply an excusable neglect standard, which I do not think the facts support in any way based on Colorado case law, there's still the equitable consideration to say, but they did not know. They did not know. And so you're going to give them essentially 6 weeks to determine what the courts have said a six-month period of time is the fair amount of time? There is an equitable consideration there. Frankly, even if you were to try to enforce 60B1, we think that if you look at Farmers, and you look at the emails, and I look at my time, I'm running out, but if you look at Farmers and you look at the emails, it just doesn't seem intellectually honest to say that the conduct of Mr. Head was excusable neglect. And if it is not excusable neglect, you have to go to 60B5, which, as the courts has described, is this reservoir of equity, which provides for circumstances that are extraordinary, incredibly unique circumstances, which is exactly what we have here. And if I could I reserve the rest of my time? My minute nine?
Hey.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Brett Lilly, registration number 25662. I represent Metro Denver Title, and I'm here with Mr. Sean Doyle as a representative of Metro Denver Title today. I think the first issue to address is Judge Richman's question about fraud. And I think it's clear that under B2, if B2 applies, then you don't get to B5. And I also think it's clear that Rule 60 states that motions shall be made within a reasonable time and for reasons one and two, not more than 6 months. So I hadn't considered the fraud angle. And I think if you read B2, it specifically says misrepresentation. So I think the court is correct in looking at that as another reason why Judge Mann was correct.
I usually anticipate misrepresentation by the other side, well, fraud by the other side, as opposed to misrepresentation by your own ally?
I think, yes, but if you read it, it says fraud, and then there's a parenthesis where they're heretofore denominated as extrinsic or extrinsic, comma, misrepresentation, comma, or other misconduct of an adverse party. And so the question would be, is or disjunctive or junctive there? I think that's an interesting point that isn't necessarily raised by the briefs here. The second point I'd like to make is that the rule is also very clear that the 6 months runs from the date of the order or judgment entered, right? It doesn't run from the date of discovery. And I think if you look at all the federal cases and all the other state cases, I've never seen a case that says the 6 months runs from the date of discovery. And that wouldn't make any sense if it did, right? Because the purpose of Rule 60 is to balance equity versus the finality of judgments. And if you were to say that 6 month period runs from the date of discovery and it's not discovered until, you know, a year after, and then the 6 months runs.
So how does this fall within subsection one? Does it fall within subsection one? And why would it be excusable neglect?
I think you have to analyze not only the attorney's alleged misconduct, Mr. Head, but also SNMC's. And I think that's what Judge Mann was looking at. In other words, if you read everything, including the cases they cite from the Ninth Circuit, Taney and Laurel, the client also has to be blameless. So if you look at Rule 1, it says mistake, inadvertent, surprise, or excusable neglect. And I think the bottom line in this case is that because SNMC's neglect, as opposed to Mr. Head's neglect, was not excusable, the trial court properly denied the motion. In other words, the trial court said, look, you learned about this in January, you executed a fee agreement February 25th, and your deadline was March 8th. And so you, SNMC, as the client, regardless of any allegations of your attorney, knew about it within the six-month period and failed to act within that six-month period. And let's remember, the standard of review is very deferential, right? It's abuse of discretion. And I think it's extraordinarily difficult under those circumstances to say that the trial court, in looking at the totality of the circumstances, abused his discretion with regard to the finding to SNMC. And I don't think anywhere do they really address that adequately. I know from my own personal experience, if I find a situation where we missed a deadline, I try to file that night, if not the next day. And so the idea that, you know, it was reasonable for them to take the time that they took and file after the deadline, I think the judge was appropriate in finding that it was not within a reasonable time under those circumstances. And I don't think there's anything in the record here that allows this court on review to say that that was an abuse of discretion. I mean, maybe in the first instance, another judge might have determined it differently, but that's not the issue on review. The issue is, did the judge abuse his discretion? And I think given the totality of the circumstances, he did not. I want to jump real quick, if I can, to the Taney and Law cases from the Ninth Circuit. First of all, I think if you review the annotations like Moore's especially, it's pretty clear that that's a minority rule. So that's number one. The second point is that none of this was ever raised to the trial court. So I think it's difficult to say that the judge abused his discretion based on cases that were never cited to him.
Do you have to cite a particular authority in support of an argument to preserve the argument?
I think you could say that the argument is preserved, and if this
we cannot consider authority that bears upon the argument because it was not cited to the trial court.
Well, I would tie it to the standard of review, Your Honor. If it was de novo review, I think certainly that you should look at new authority or authority that was not cited to the trial court. But if the question is, did the trial court abuse his discretion, it's difficult, at least in my mind, to say that a trial court abuses his discretion based on authority that was never cited to him. You know, had this authority been cited to him, that's one thing, but it wasn't.
Were the underlying reasons cited to him?
The argument was.
And so simply because you've got the reasons, but simply because you don't have the name of a case, you think that's, you know, the case is not preserved, or for our review, we cannot consider that case?
I think the court should be very careful in doing that because of the abuse of discretion standard of review. And I understand what the court is arguing, and I would tend to agree that if you make an argument and there's case law that supports it, you should be able to rely on that. But the counterbalance to that is, as I say, it's difficult to say that the trial court abused discretion based on cases that were never presented to the trial court. And I would point out that the opposition at the trial court did cite federal law, and so it was only SNMC that did not cite federal law. So that's the difficulty that I have. I guess I would concede that the argument was preserved for review, but I would say that it's very difficult to say that. Here's how I would say it. It's not that it wasn't preserved for review, but that it's difficult, if not impossible, to say that the trial court abused his discretion, given that that case law was not presented to him. And so that's maybe a fine distinction, but I think an appropriate one in this case. But even if you look at this Ninth Circuit opinion and some of the other case law, first of all, I think the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Pioneer supersedes it, and that's why it's a minority rule. Second of all, if you look at Taney, which was the first case, they were very clear that gross negligence is not imputed to the client if it's beyond the client's control. And that was also the case in Lowell. And I think if you look at every case that they cite, this idea that the client has to be blameless or that they have to be circumstances beyond the client's control, right? That's what exceptional circumstances means, right? Or extraordinary circumstances in extreme situations. So to back up a second, if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court case of Claprot, their default was reversed because it was impossible for the client to defend because he was incarcerated and sick. And so that was an extreme and extraordinary circumstance beyond his control. If you contrast the U.S. Supreme Court case of Ackerman, that case, the client chose not to appeal and rely, I think, on his brother appealing, and then years later came back and tried to challenge his judgment based on the successful appeal of his judgment, brother's appeal. And what the Supreme Court says is essentially the difference between those cases is the idea of choice versus no choice, and that there must be a lack of fault and ability to control on the client's part. So if you fast forward to Taney, they explicitly note that that's a situation where if it's beyond the client's control, that gross negligence of a lawyer is a different situation. Well, all of that here means that it wasn't beyond SNMC's control, as we've discussed, right? They had sufficient time to do something, and they didn't. And so that, I think, was really the critical part of Judge Madden's ruling, is that if you reduce it all down to whether it's 60B1 or 60B5, under either instance, they had an opportunity to timely fix this, and they failed to do that. And at the end of the day, right, Rule 60 is an equitable determination. It explicitly says, upon such terms as are just. And so when you weigh the importance of finality of judgments versus their failure to act in a timely way and the prejudice that's going to occur to all the parties, I mean, this case was filed back in 2008, right? And it's now 2012. And so the idea that we're going to reopen this case and that it's, you know, the evidence is not stale at this point. I think the prejudice to the defendants in this case would be extreme, opening a case this old. So I think at the end of the day, there are not just terms to say that they did not act in a reasonable time. Now, there's no specific case law in Colorado dealing with attorney gross negligence under Rule 5 or Subsection 5, but I think if you look at Kavanaugh, the Centennial Bank of the West case, and also the SR Condominiums LLC case, and also the Davidson case from 2001, in all four of those cases, both this court and the Supreme Court has said that failures by legal counsel do not suffice for relief under Rule 5, especially, and this is the key point, especially where the party contributes to the delay. So I think if you look at those four cases from both this court and the Supreme Court, and you tie that in with all the analysis from the federal court precedent that SMMC relies on, specifically the idea of being beyond the client's control, the idea is the same, right? If the party is contributing to the delay, or if they fail to act in a timely manner, then they should not be able to invoke the idea of equitable relief. A couple of points on the bottom of this in terms of equitable relief. SMMC has a malpractice action. And if you look at Kavanaugh, which explicitly cites the Link opinion from the United States Supreme Court, I think Colorado fairly incorporates the idea that the client is responsible for the attorney's conduct. And one other distinction I think is important to be made here is that this was a dismissal without prejudice, so the plaintiff was getting dismissed. And if you look at the Taney case in particular, that was a default judgment where the defendant had a judgment entered against them. And part of the Taney ruling said, look, if you're a defendant and you get a default judgment, in that case for $2 million, the idea that you have a malpractice action doesn't save you from having to defend against that $2 million judgment from the time it's entered to the time you get your malpractice action. Well, that's not the case here. They don't have a judgment entered against them, right? They were looking to recover. So there's no prejudice to them by pursuing their malpractice action. Contrast that to the prejudice of the defendants having to defend an over four-year-old case at this point. Let's see. Now, I think the fact that a fee agreement was executed on February 25th, and this was close to 2 weeks, maybe 11 days, before the six-month deadline of March 8th, means that the party, in other words, SMNC, is accountable for the negligence and mistakes of their counsel. So that's the B1 analysis. Now, if you go up to the B5 analysis, I think, first of all, the extraordinary circumstances and extreme situations, if you go through all the annotations and look at those types of situations where relief has been granted versus the situations where relief has not been granted, in addition to the factors of the client being responsible for the delay, as we talked about here, or at least not acting within the timeline available to them, the extreme situations are way more extreme in the cases granting relief than anything that's alleged here. The virtual inability of the client to defend themselves is a common refrain. And I think important here is that SMNC had in-house counsel, right? And at one point, they applied to be pro hac vici, and that was denied on procedural grounds, and they never availed themselves of the opportunity to refile that motion. So A, they failed on the pro hac vici part to be involved. B, they had in-house counsel. And C, when you add all that up with they knew about it in January, they executed a fee agreement in February, and even with all that, they still had time to act within 6 months. It's pretty clear to me that under those circumstances, it's impossible to say that the judge abused his discretion. Thank you.
think it was a minute nine. Very quickly, Judge Madden did not look at Colorado Supreme Court law to determine what excusable neglect was. He simply decided it without looking at Colorado case law to determine what it is. Had he looked at the Farmers case, he would have said, this isn't excusable neglect, and we wouldn't be having a 60B1 conversation, and we wouldn't be having a six-month conversation. That's the first thing. The second thing, the SR condominium case, please take a look at it and read it. Of course you will. It has nothing to do with the facts of this case. It has to do with, it has a 60B5 motion, but other than that, it has to do with new law being decided 5 days before the trial court entered a decision.
Has dealt with liens.
Beg your pardon?
That dealt with liens and a change in the lien statute.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Yes. So it has not, other than the fact that it was a 60B5 motion, there is absolutely no application whatsoever.
Cited for the motion that 60B5 applies only when the situations are not covered by parts 1 through 4. You don't disagree with that proposition.
I do not disagree with that proposition, but he, it appeared, can I continue? I'm out of time.
I'm done.
Yeah, but it would appear that he was citing it in support of not applying 60B5 after finding that it was excusable neglect. I guess I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. The case stands submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. We appreciate your arguments, and we thank you for your time. And there are no other cases on the docket this afternoon, so with that, the bailiff may announce a recess.